Lecture 4, John Stuart Mill and Utilitarianism.
As we begin discussing John Stuart Mill, we're moving out of the 18th century and into the 19th century. Mill was born in 1806. He's the son of James Mill, who was an economist in his own right, although not as famous as his son turned out to be. But James Mill, Mill's father, was the one who actually persuaded David Ricardo that it was worthwhile to start writing some of his books and to publish them, and also persuaded Ricardo to run for Parliament. So he was sort of a well-connected person among those people of the time. He raised John Stuart Mill to be a child prodigy. There's no other way to put it. And the best description of Mill's early upbringing is from his own autobiography, which is written late in life, but is really worth reading today because it's just such an amazing description of what it must have been like to grow up as Mill. For example, in describing his childhood and early education, he says, "I have no remembrance of the time when I began to learn Greek. I have been told that it was when I was 3 years old. My earliest recollection on the subject is that of committing to memory what my father termed vocables, being lists of common Greek words with their signification in English, which he wrote out for me on cards. Of grammar, until some years later, I learned no more than the inflections of the nouns and verbs. And I faintly remember going through Aesop's Fables, the first Greek book which I read. I learned no Latin until my 8th year. At that time I had read under my father's tuition a number of Greek prose authors, among whom I remember the whole of Herodotus, some of Xenophon's Cirripedia, the memorials of Socrates, some of the lives of philosophers by Diogenes Laertius, part of Lucian, and Isocrates Ad Demonicum and Ad Nicolum. I also read in 1813, this is when he would have been about 8, the first 6 dialogues of Plato, from the Euthyphron to the Thetis inclusive, which last dialogue I venture to think would have been better omitted, as it was totally impossible that I should understand it. In my 8th year I commenced learning Latin, and I made my first commencement in the Greek poets with the Iliad. Soon after this time I commenced Euclid, and somewhat later algebra, still under my father's tuition. From my 8th to my 12th year, the Latin books I remember reading were the Bucolics of Virgil, the first 6 books of the Aeneid, all Horace, except for the Epodes, the Fables of Phaedrus, the first 5 books of Livy, and so on, and so on, and so on, and so on. You just begin to read along on this, and you think, this man had a very strange upbringing. And then he goes on and says, as to my private readings, and begins to describe to you all the things that he read as a private student. He was raised to be a prodigy. He was raised to carry the flag of a new kind of economics. He was raised to be the social reformer who would save the world. And his dad focused on that from a very, very early age. One of the nicest parts of reading Mill's autobiography is the sense that he keeps saying of, well, anyone could really do this. I mean, this isn't really that big a deal. I just had a father who taught me a lot of stuff. He writes at one point, "The results of the experiment with me show the ease with which this may be done. If I had been by nature extremely quick of apprehension, or had possessed a very accurate and retentive memory, or were of remarkably active and energetic character, this trial would not be conclusive. But in all these natural gifts, I am rather below than above par, and what I could do could assuredly be done by any boy or girl of average capacity and healthy physical constitution." So Mill's notion was everyone should just get this kind of education. It'll all work out fine. One interesting point to remember in that sentence I just read to you, it could assuredly be done by any boy or girl of average capacity and physical constitution. That inclusion of women is actually something of a new trend coming into thinking about society as a whole. So, Mill is growing up through his 20s, he's editing his father's works, he's contributing to learned periodicals, and he's wrestling with a philosophy, the philosophy of utilitarianism. Now, I need to describe for you briefly what utilitarianism is. Utilitarianism is a philosophy which is usually associated with Jeremy Bentham, a British philosopher, and the notion was that all of the good or evil in the world should be measured in terms of whether it contributes to people's happiness or not. And utility is just a word that's being used to mean happiness. Does it cause pain or pleasure? At the very beginning of Bentham's Introduction to the Principles of Morals and Legislation, which was published originally in 1780, he sums it this way. "Nature has placed mankind under the governance of 2 sovereign masters, pain and pleasure. It is for them alone to point out what we ought to do, as well as to determine what we shall do.
On the one hand, the standard of right and wrong, on the other, the chain of causes and effects, are fastened to their throne. They govern us in all we do, in all we say, in all we think. The principle of utility recognizes this subjection. By the principle of utility is meant the principle which approves or disapproves of every action whatsoever, according to the tendency which it appears to have to augment or diminish the happiness of the party whose interest is in question. Or what is the same thing, in other words, to promote or to oppose that happiness. I say every action whatsoever, and therefore not only every action of a private individual, but every measurement of government. An action may then be said to be conformable to the principle of utility when the tendency it has to augment the happiness of the community is greater than any it has to diminish it. And Bentham also took the fairly radical step of saying that when he talked about people's happiness, he was counting every individual in the community, not just the lords or the royals or the nobles or the people who ran the government. In another place he wrote, "Everyone is to count for one and nobody for more than one." So if you think about it, the sort of individualism that was starting in the Middle Ages and comes up through Hume and Adam Smith in terms of caring about the welfare of individuals now reaches kind of a radical level of equality in Bentham, that everybody is equal. Everybody counts for one, nobody for more than one. Where does utilitarianism take you in terms of philosophy? Well, because everyone counted for one, nobody counted for more than one, and everyone's happiness matters, the utilitarians were people who tended to favor universal suffrage. They tended to favor a secret ballot. They favored, you know, looking after the poor and helping them build up their lives, jobs for the unemployed at slack times. They favored free trade and competition, but they also favored things like prison reform, which were not popular subjects at the time. And a group of people called philosophical radicals, of whom Mill was one of the leading lights, started around these utilitarian principles that everyone mattered, we should care about everyone's happiness. The utilitarians are important because, in a way, they offered a balancing language for how you could say, I don't like child labor, or I worry about poor people, or I worry about poverty and pain that people are suffering. The language was utility. It's causing more pain than pleasure. If it's causing more pain than pleasure, it's a bad thing. And so that language was a very powerful tool of social reformers through the early part of the 19th century. However, without simplifying this too much, you can see that this is maybe not a full philosophy in and of itself. I mean, after all, if everyone is an island, and all that matters is their pain or pleasure, individually defined, you know, where's love? You know, where's justice? Where's honor? Where's altruism? Those things don't show up very directly in a world where we're very individual and just thinking about the pleasure and pain of each individual as a separate person. This may contribute, along with his earlier education, to the fact that Mill, in his early 1920s, has a nervous breakdown. And in his autobiography, he describes this nervous breakdown. He says, "It was in the autumn of 1826. I was in a dull state of nerves, such as everybody is occasionally liable to, unsusceptible to enjoyment or pleasurable excitement. One of those moods when what is pleasure at other times becomes insipid or indifferent. The state, I should think, in which converts to Methodism usually are when smitten by their first conviction of sin. In this frame of mind, it occurred to me to put the question directly to myself. Suppose that all your objects in life were realized, that all the changes in institutions and opinions which you're looking forward to could be completely effected at this very instant. Would this be a great joy and happiness to you?" And an irrepressible self-consciousness distinctly answered, "No." At this, my heart sank within me. The whole foundation on which my life was constructed fell down. All my happiness was to have been found in the continual pursuit of this end. The end had ceased to charm. How could there ever again be any interest in the means? I seemed to have nothing left to live for. I became persuaded that my love of mankind and of excellence for its own sake had worn itself out. This world of utilitarianism, while it offered all these glorious ideas for social reform, didn't somehow offer a kind of nourishment to Mill that he felt his spirit needed in some way. How does he rescue himself? Well, it's like some romantic poem. He reads Wordsworth. He thinks about nature. He thinks about the beauty of divine creation. He thinks about the interconnectedness of everything. He listens to music, and he falls in love. And he falls in love with, at age 24, with a woman named Harriet Taylor. No relation. Unfortunately, when he fell in love with Harriet Taylor, there was also a Mr. Taylor. She had been married for some years. And they spent 20 years in love while she remained married to Mr. Taylor. 20 years of conversation. 20 years of occasionally taking trips, just the two of them, to Europe, scandalous at the time. 20 years of writing things back and forth. As far as we know, we do have a reasonable amount of their personal correspondence. As far as we know, they were completely chaste in this relationship, that Mill would not have done such a thing as betray the marriage vows of someone else. But for their time, this was extraordinarily controversial stuff. After her husband dies, 20 years of this courtship, they then marry. And they live together for 7 years until she dies. And then Mill lives with her daughter from Mr. Taylor after that until the end of his life. There's an ongoing dispute among intellectual historians as to how much of Mill's work was really due to Harriet Taylor. Mill was a really modest fellow, as you may have gathered from some of his earlier comments. And he's always saying stuff like, well, there's nothing in this that's original to me in any way. I'm not original. It's all in Adam Smith. It's all in someone else. And so when he wrote things, he tended to say, well, it's all Harriet, you know, or it's all Adam Smith, or it's all David Ricardo. And so for a long time, the point of view was, this is just Mill being modest. He gives credit to Harriet, but, you know, he gives credit to everybody. On the other hand, with sort of revolution in feminist scholarship over the last 20 or 30 years, more and more people have come to think, well, you know, maybe he really did take a lot of this from Harriet. Maybe they really did work together on a lot of these things. My own sense is that a lot of Mill's writings, famous writings on things like On Liberty or his famous essay on the subjection of women, that concern for equality and fair treatment of the other sex, I think clearly were strongly formed by Harriet Taylor, who was, by all accounts, a very strong-minded woman and person. On the other hand, his pure economics writing, which is mainly what we're interested in this lecture, probably had less impact from her, although it did have some, as we'll talk about. Our main focus here is not some of Mill's great essays, like his essays on liberty or considerations of representative government or his essay on utilitarianism, all things that still show up in a lot of undergraduate curriculums. What we really want to focus on is his book, The Principles of Political Economy, which was first published in 1848 and was sort of the unchallenged last word on economics until really the 1890s. So if you sort of think about the progression of great books in economics, people read The Wealth of Nations. People who really wanted to study hard read Ricardo's Principles of Political Economy. And the next great book from which many people learned the subject was Mill's Principles of Political Economy. What is the economics of Mill? Where does this economics consist of? When we think of Mill, what you really should be thinking of is that he's sort of the end of a school which is referred to as classical economics. It starts with Adam Smith and really runs through Mill. Some people would argue it runs through Marx as well, but through that middle 1850s. And by classical school, what we're really talking about is a set of beliefs which sort of hold together across the diverse writings of these people, with some disagreement, of course, as always. Two modern economists, Jacob Osser and Stanley Brew, defined the five characteristics of the classical model in this way. They said, one is the classical economists believed in minimal government involvement. They believed, you know, don't have the poor laws, get the government out of subsidizing industry, have the free force of the market at work. A second thing was that self-interested behavior is a part of human nature. It's not sinful, it's not evil, it's just part of human nature, and it's where economic behavior is generated from. A third belief is that broadly, by seeking out, when individuals seek out their own interests, some sort of social harmony will result, in keeping with Adam Smith's invisible hand. Fourth, the classical economists emphasized that all resources had some economic value in all activities. Remember, the physiocrats, for example, used to say only agriculture has value, nothing else does. Or sometimes they would sort of say, well, only labor has value, nothing else does. But if you read broadly through their writings, you can see there's definitely an awareness that all sorts of things, land, labor, capital, entrepreneurs, all activities, agriculture, commerce, production, trade, all those things are generating some kind of value. So in a broad way, we're getting away from that concept that only certain things are productive and into a more modern way of thinking about the economy, that lots of things add value in a broader way. And their fifth and final tenet of the classical school was they liked to try and build up economic laws. They wanted to think about laws that would govern behavior. And so, for example, we've talked about Say's law. Supply brings forth its own demand. Malthus's population law. The labor theory of value is a law like that. And Ricardo's theory of comparative advantage. They tried to come up and articulate certain laws which would be how the economic world worked. Mill really is at the top, or at the last stage, of this classical tradition. And he really is a classical economist. But as you'll see in a moment, as we talk about the things Mill said and did, many of them are somehow beyond the classical economics, or they're pushing it one step further. And you can begin to see the cracks in classical economics forming a little bit. Let's talk about some of the particular contributions that Mill makes in economics. First of all, Mill is really the first one to lay out an idea of supply and demand, which is fairly similar to our modern idea. It's not fully similar yet. That'll wait another 50 years or so. But in a written term and with some allowance for a vagueness of expression, he begins to come very close to thinking about supply and demand as the two factors that really determine price. And so this notion of markets determining prices through supply and demand is much clearer in Mill than it was before. Now, of course, being John Stuart Mill, he would say, well, you know, I didn't really have anything to do here. There was nothing new here. In his Principles, he writes, the question of value is fundamental. Happily, there is nothing in the laws of value which remains for the present or any future writer to clear up. The theory on the subject is complete. The only difficulty to be overcome is of stating it. Now, you and I know, the theory is not complete. I mean, the theory of value is an awful mess. It's got all these things going on in every direction. But, you know, Mill being Mill is like, well, I have nothing original to add here. It's all complete. I'll just spell out a few things and just mention it along the way. So he proceeds to talk about supply and demand and how they lead to things in an altogether different way. Let me give you one example. He writes, demand and supply, the quantity demanded and the quantity supplied, will be made equal in the market. If unequal at any moment, competition will equalize them. The manner in which this is done is by an adjustment of the value, by which he means the price, really. If the demand increases, the value, the price, rises. If the demand diminishes, the value, the price, falls. Again, if the supply falls off, the value rises and falls if the supply is increased. The rise or fall continues until supply and demand are once again equal to one another. And the value which a commodity will bring in any market is no other than the value which in that market gives a demand just sufficient to carry off the existing or expected supply. This is the law of value. Now, that's very close to our modern notion of economics. If demand goes up, more demand means the price rises. If demand goes down, means the price falls. Supply goes up, the price drops off. Supply drops and something becomes more scarce, the price tends to rise. If there are big shortages or big surpluses, the price adjusts in order to get rid of those surpluses. And so Mill is really articulating in a fairly clear way something that's very close to our own notion of supply and demand. His terminology is a little different. He's still using this value term instead of prices, but it's very nearly there in a funny way. So one step for one thing we can give Mill credit for is really building that sense of how adjustment works in this kind of a market. He also began to think about things like what happens in a market where the output, the supply, doesn't change over time. And he explained that, well, if it's a market where the supply doesn't change, then the amount of demand will determine the price that's charged. On the other hand, if it's a market where the supply changes a lot, then the changes in supply will determine what price is charged. And he begins to think about these different sorts of distinctions in very specific ways, laying out supply and demand as different factors and thinking about their interrelationship. He begins to think about what changes happen in the short term, what changes happen in the long term, what happens in between. And much of this short term, long term language is stuff that we now draw on all the time. But Mill was the first one to start laying out those distinctions in a nice, clear way. Now, as I quoted before from Malthus, these supply and demand terms have been thrown around before. But I really think Mill took them to a new level in a way that changes how economists and other people thought of the subject. However, Mill was not a pure market kind of guy any more than Adam Smith was. He also began to recognize particular examples and problems that come up in markets. For example, he began to emphasize the problems that can happen if you have what we would now call economies of scale. That is, if it's very efficient for the operation to be extremely large. Because if it's efficient for the operation to be extremely large, it will be hard to have competition from smaller producers. So Mill writes, when in any employment the system of many work people under one management has become established, from that time any further enlargement in the scale of production is generally a benefit. It's obvious, for example, how great an economy of labor would be obtained if London were supplied by a single gas or water company instead of the existing many companies. While there are even as many as two companies, this applies double establishments of all sorts, when one only could probably perform the whole operation equally well. Double sets of machinery and works, when the whole of the gas or water required could generally be produced by one set only. So he's saying, you know, competition doesn't work so well in providing gas and water. Those are things where you get duplication, and it would be good to have one big company. The problem, of course, is if you have one big company, then you get monopoly. He writes, where competitors are few, they always end by agreeing not to compete. They may run a race of cheapness to ruin a new candidate, but as soon as he established his footing, they come to terms with him. When, therefore, a business of real public importance can only be carried on advantageously on a large scale, it is an unthrifty dispensation of public resources that several costly sets of arrangements should be kept up for the purpose of rendering to the community this one service. It is much better to treat it at once as a public function. So Mill begins to say, look, for certain things like water and gas production, the market doesn't work well. Here's why. It's not efficient to have a whole bunch of competing producers. We need to think about treating those as public functions. Now, that's clearly a step away from sort of the laissez-faire, classical, let-the-market-work kind of attitude. Mill also made contributions that are fundamental in clarifying the ideas about international trade. He supported free trade strongly on sort of Adam Smith grounds, you know, and David Hume grounds as well, that it was something which benefited you because you were able to buy from abroad, it benefited your standard of living, it helped you specialize, it helped the division of labor on an international basis, helped greater production. And so he was very much a supporter of free trade in general. He also built up an international model, which sort of draws upon Ricardo's theory of comparative advantage. Ricardo's argument of comparative advantage, you may remember, sort of argued that everybody should chip in, everybody should help out, and it can benefit everybody to chip in and help out. What Ricardo didn't answer is, who should do how much of what? How much should people chip in? Who gets most of the benefit if everybody chips in? Does most of the benefit go to the good producers or the weaker producers? Well, Mill took on that question and began to analyze different circumstances under which different kinds of producers might be benefited or helped. For example, he said, imagine that we're talking about some good we import from another country, and imagine that they're becoming more and more efficient in what they do. Now, there are two possibilities as they become more and more efficient. One possibility is we buy more of the good as they become more and more efficient. And as we buy more and more of the good, they're going to benefit. The other possibility is, say that as they become more and more efficient, we don't buy any more of the good, but the price goes down and down and down and down, reflecting their greater efficiency. If that's true, Mill said, then we would be benefiting from their greater efficiency. So he began to divide up the world into situations where one side benefits more from trade, another side benefits more from trade, and thinking about how those different kinds of balances work. Mill was also well known for being willing to consider the possibility that sometimes free trade might not be a great idea. He's the father of what we now call the infant industry argument. The infant industry argument is the idea that sometimes it makes sense to provide a subsidy to a baby industry or an infant industry to help it grow up, and then we would remove the subsidy later on. So Mill writes, the only case in which, on mere principles of political economy, protecting duties, that is to say, shutting out imports, can be defensible, is when they are imposed temporarily, especially in a young and rising nation, in hopes of naturalizing a foreign industry. The superiority of one country over another in a branch of production often arises only from having begun it sooner. A protecting duty, continued for a reasonable time, might sometimes be the least inconvenient mode in which the nation can tax itself for the support of an experiment, like building up a new industry. And then he writes, but it is essential that the protection should be confined to cases in which there is good ground of assurance that the industry which it fosters will after a time be able to dispense with it. Nor should the domestic producers ever be allowed to expect that it will be continued to them beyond the time necessary for a fair trial of what they can accomplish. So temporarily protecting an industry is something that Mill writes is, you know, can make sense in various cases, even though he's a strong, strong supporter of free trade. Yet another contribution of Mill to our economic thinking is his notion of the stationary state. In the earlier writers, like Malthus, like Smith, when we talked about where the economy was headed, you may remember that it was always sort of headed towards something like the workers are going to get pushed toward less and less and less. They're going to get pushed towards subsistence. They're not going to be able to do very well. Profits will generally evaporate over time. And the economy will reach some level, some stationary place, where it's just not growing anymore, and things have sort of leveled out. Economists refer to that time when everything has leveled out as a stationary state. And previous economists had always thought of the stationary state as being somehow a bad thing, a worrisome thing, that we would slow down and eventually we would stop. Mill gave a completely different spin to the stationary state. He said, I cannot, therefore, regard the stationary state of capital and wealth with the unaffected aversion so generally manifested toward it by economists of the old school. I am inclined to believe the stationary state would be, on the whole, a very considerable improvement on our present condition. I confess I am not charmed with the ideal of life held out by those who think that the normal state of human beings is that of struggling to get on, and that the trampling, crushing, elbowing, and treading on each other's heels, which form the pattern of social life, are the most desirable lot of humankind, or anything but the disagreeable symptoms of one of the phases of industrial progress. It may be a necessary stage in the progress of civilization, but the best state for human nature is that in which, while no one is poor, no one desires to be richer, nor has any reason to fear being thrust back by the efforts of others to push themselves forward. So we're getting toward, you can imagine, the philosophical radicals here, and a sense of going back to these utopian visions, that people don't want to push themselves forward, that instead it would be kind of a nice world if everyone sort of reached a stationary situation and was kind of happy with how that turned out. And that vision that, you know, all this acquisitiveness, I don't really like it somehow. I'd like it if we reached a more polite and pleasant world, is a strong echo coming through Mill in a number of different ways. In fact, he goes so far as to say later on in the book that hitherto, it is questionable if all the mechanical inventions yet made have lightened the day's toil of any human being. They have enabled a greater population to live the same life of drudgery and imprisonment, and an increased number of manufacturers and others to make fortunes. They have increased the comforts of the middle class, but they have not yet begun to effect those great changes in human destiny which it is in their nature and their future to accomplish. Only when, in addition to just institutions, the increase of mankind shall be under the deliberate guidance of judicious foresight, can the conquests made from the powers of nature, by the intellect and energy of scientific discoverers, become the common property of the species, and a means of improving and elevating the universal lot. Judicial foresight. Oversight of technological invention. Things being divided up fairly and equally. We're clearly beginning to get away from this laissez-faire notion of the market just allocating everything and getting into more of a world where we begin to think about, well, how do we want this to come out? How are we going to allocate things? How are we going to shape what's going on? It shouldn't surprise you, given this kind of tone, that Mill is extremely open to many different kinds of government intervention. He writes in a famous passage that the only way to think about government intervention is in terms of what's expedient. He says, look, let's be realistic. You look at all these laissez-faire guys, and they say, well, just let the market work. But then they say, well, of course, the government will have to build roads and canals and educate people and run paper money. It'll have to do this and that and the other. He says, those things are just a list of things the government should do. And we shouldn't be scared of those things. We should just say, okay, that's what the government does. You know, we're not tense about it. It's just what it's going to happen. So he begins to be someone who, again, goes back almost to the Adam Smith tradition of thinking about government not as an evil, but as something that plugs certain holes and accomplishes certain functions. On the other hand, I shouldn't give you the wrong idea. Like Smith, he was perfectly capable of being a bitter critic of government. He wrote, "In all the more advanced communities, the great majority of things are worse done by the intervention of government than the individuals most interested in the matter would do them." He wrote, "It must be remembered, besides, that even if a government were superior in intelligence and knowledge to any single individual, it will be inferior to all the individuals of the nation taken together." So Mill's notion of government was not that it should do everything, but that when we talk about government, we should give up our ideologies and we should just say, what's expedient here? You know, what makes sense? We should be very pragmatic about it. And we should get away from saying we're preaching laissez-faire or we're preaching something else. This is clearly not a pure laissez-faire kind of guy. But with all that, I think Mill, it's fair to say, had a deeper understanding of how competition really works than almost anyone before him. I would leave Adam Smith out of that. But he had a really strong sense of why competition was a powerful thing. He wrote about this in terms of his response to the socialists and the utopians of his time. He said, "I utterly dissent from the most conspicuous and vehement part of socialist teaching, their declamations against competition. They forget that wherever competition is not, monopoly is. And that monopoly, in all its forms, is taxation of the industrious for the support of indolence, if not of plunder. It is a common error of socialists to overlook the natural indolence of mankind, their tendency to be passive, to be slaves of habit, to persist indefinitely in a course once chosen. Competition may not be the best conceivable stimulus, but it is at present a necessary one, and no one can foresee the time when it will not be indispensable to progress. Instead of looking upon competition as the baneful and antisocial principle, which it is held to be by the generality of socialists, I conceive that even in the present state of society and industry, every restriction of competition is an evil, and every extension of it, even if for the time injuriously affecting some class of laborers, is always an ultimate good. To be protected against competition is to be protected in idleness, in mental dullness, to be saved the necessity of being active and as intelligent as other people." That's really the case for competition. I mean, you may not like competition, but let's be honest about human nature. Without competition, how many people are really going to work hard? How many people are going to avoid indolence? Isn't there some sense in which competition pushes us all forward, even if it's gentle, friendly competition? And Mill, although he's clearly willing to support government, is not going to let us forget that important role of competition. And like Smith, he's going to seize on the human side of it, not some theoretical David Ricardo type model. Mill was not a great innovator in economics. Many of these ideas draw upon previous writers. I wouldn't want to claim that he's, you know, as high in the pantheon as some of the more original thinkers. But like Adam Smith, he pulled together an enormous number of things. And in pulling together those things, there's a role for that kind of thought as well, and systematically organizing the thoughts that are out there. Another contribution of Mill to the history of economic thought is that Mill is really the one who came up with the idea of economic man, or in the way we sort of describe it today, of homo economicus. What is this idea of economic man? It's an idea which a lot of people have this extremely knee-jerk negative reaction to. But in an 1836 essay, Mill described the notion of thinking about people and what they want to accomplish in terms of starting off with a few main goals. The goals he used were, you said you could think of people and selfish people in terms of the following goals: building up wealth, enjoying luxuries, their desire for leisure, and, being a good Victorian writer that he was, their desire to procreate and have a family. And he said those are the four big goals people have in their life. And we should be able to think about most of people's actions and behaviors in thinking about these goals and how they trade them back and forth against each other. Now, of course, we do it a little differently today. Now we talk about people's desire for income, their desire for savings, their desire for working and saving and different things like that. And we use those to think about decisions about education and family and so on. But my point here is the question of whether or not it makes sense to take people and boil them down, boil down human motivations to this economic idea of man, where the way you think about people is that they're trying to do a certain limited number of things in their own selfish self-interest. Mill argued, in many contexts, throughout the principles of political economy, that this was actually a very freeing and liberal way to think about people. He gave examples of things like Irish immigrants who had gone to the United States. He said, what changed when Irish immigrants left Ireland and went to the United States? What changed was not their human nature. That was the same in both places. What changed was that institutions in the United States encouraged them to work and gave them opportunities. And so in their own selfish self-interest, they started off with those new institutions working harder and harder. And they were able to be economically much more successful. So for Mill, this idea of economic man was a way of saying, if you put people in different social institutions, some good and supportive, some of which limit them, you will give them an opportunity in following up on their own selfish needs and desires to better themselves. And that when we think about social policy, we should think about this interaction of institutions and what people want. Today, and all through the 19th century as well, when you hear people talk about economic man, what you hear people saying is something like, well, you're just saying people are narrow and selfish and that they only want a few limited things. And this all goes back straight to Mill's idea of economic man. It's certainly true in one way that this idea of people seeking a limited number of things is a limited version of human nature. I mean, there are many parts of humanity that it doesn't cover. On the other hand, if you're going to think about economic policy, you're going to think about the interaction of institutions and what's likely to happen under different laws and different social arrangements, you can do a lot worse than start from some fairly simple model that says people are going to try and earn an income, they're going to try and take time off, they're going to try and have children, they're going to try and have some luxuries. I mean, that kind of a model actually is extraordinarily powerful for starting off to explain the world. I would say that if you're really trying to understand human nature, don't start with economists. You know, start with the plays of Shakespeare or something like that. But if you're trying to understand narrowly economic behavior and how institutions and human nature go back and forth, the idea of economic man is worth defending. And Mill was, you know, a gentle, loving, reasonable, liberal person. He was not saying these things to try and limit what people could do. What's Mill's impact overall, if we try and summarize the impact he had on economics? I sort of think of Mill as hanging between two poles and sort of swaying back and forth between them over his career. On one side is sort of good classical economist. And the other side is kind of utilitarianism and utopianism, where he really wants to have as little pain in the world as possible, and he's willing to think about aggressively changing the world in order to get to that place where everybody will be happier. And like many economists today, he sort of varies back and forth between, you know, well, I'm in favor of competition in markets, but boy, I sure would like to help poor people, but boy, I'd be in favor of this, and he leans back and forth between the two. You can almost see him wriggling his shoulders or something like that as he tries to write. One of the most powerful parts of this separation, I think, is when he talks about the difference between production and distribution of things. Now, up until then, in economics, we thought about efficient production as being one thing. And then we sort of said, well, you have to produce efficiently. And that's kind of the end of the story. Mill was the first one to point out we could separate out the idea of producing efficiently from the idea of how the production is distributed. We could have a market that decides how everything is produced, but then we could go back and distribute those things however we wanted. In his autobiography, he gives credit for this insight to Harriet Taylor. He says, it was chiefly her influence that gave my book, Political Economy, the general tone by which it is distinguished from all previous expositions of political economy. The tone consisted chiefly in making the proper distinction between the laws of production of wealth, which are real laws of nature, and there he's talking about supply and demand and things like that, dependent on the properties of objects, and the modes of distribution of wealth, which subject to certain conditions depends on human will. The common run of political economists confuse these together under the designation of economic laws. So he started saying, look, we could have a world where we had an efficient market running on supply and demand principles, but we redistribute some things to other people, or we help other people in different ways. Now, that's a bit of an exaggeration about the world. Of course, when you start taking from some and giving to others, you change incentives and you alter the market. You can't completely separate production and distribution, as Mill talks about. But you can come somewhat close to it. And it's a useful way to think about the world in terms of let markets do what markets do well, and then if we have a problem with markets, think about addressing that through a different kind of distribution. But don't destroy the market because you have a distributive goal. So keep those two things somewhat separate in your mind. Mill, because of his thoughts about separating production and distribution, was actually fairly willing to consider things like socialism. After all, he said you could have socialism which had efficient production and different distribution. His big complaint against socialism was not that it was not laissez-faire or something like that. His big complaint was just that it hadn't been tried very well and the socialists weren't being very realistic. They weren't thinking about things like, we need to have competition. And so they just weren't thinking realistically about this separation. In their own way, they were getting confused by saying we'd like a different distribution, so we have to change the laws of production. And Mill argued that what you could think about instead was an improved and better capitalism. An improved and better capitalism with better education, better opportunities for people, and that that new and improved capitalism might well be better than socialism. We just had no way of knowing either way, because we didn't have any evidence on what socialism would be like, and we didn't have any evidence on what this new and improved capitalism would be like. So as always, Mill comes back to this notion of, let's do what's expedient. You know, this is just a matter of thinking about what works. So let's think about whether socialism would work. Let's think about whether something else would work. And then let's move forward with it. Let's not get wrapped up in ideology over different things. Finally, I think Mill offers a really unique kind of spirit for modern economists. And it's a spirit which we could use more of, probably in the economics profession and in the world as a whole. It's an insistence where, on the one hand, you have to consider the laws of economics and respect them. You have to understand the power of competition, the power of supply and demand, the power of trade, and you have to respect those powerful forces. And that requires study, requires hard effort. It's a hard subject. Economics is not trivial. On the other hand, Mill is willing to say, hey, if we want to think about a high tax rate on rich people, or we want to think about redistributing things, that's okay. We're willing to consider all those possibilities. All I insist on is that first you understand the hard realities of what's going to happen. And then later on, if you want to switch over and consider the other possibilities, that would be just fine. Mill was not a revolutionary. In a way, some people find him frustrating, I think, because they sort of want Mill to be saying, be a socialist, go do it, redistribute the income, fight back against the economy, toss over the classical economics, toss it aside. In our modern age, I sometimes feel like we value anger, we value the revolutionary side of people. We say it's authentic to be angry or something like that. Mill was not an angry man. He was a gentle and a polite and a loving man. In my own view, a lot of the times, revolutionary anger feeds on itself and becomes an end in itself, and it has very little to do with improving the lot of people. Mill was not a revolutionary. He was better than a revolutionary. He was an earnest and hardworking reformer who stood up for all kinds of reforms in a constructive spirit with a loyalty to his society. He was very aggressive in his own way, but not about overthrow or violence. A fine modern economist named Victor Fuchs described his own philosophy a few years ago. He said, politically, I am a radical moderate. Moderate because I believe the need for balance, both in the goals we set and the institutions that we nourish. Radical because I believe this position should be expressed as vigorously and as forcefully as extremists on the right and left push theirs. At their best, many top economists are radical moderates. I think the world could use more radical moderation.